Welcome to the Conway Show. We've got a special guest today, Alex Johnson. I'm very excited to get Alex down. Been sort of chatting to him over the last sort of couple of months during the run. I've known Alex for a long time, played with him, played against him. Big arch rivals of Xavier College. Yeah, obviously, thanks for coming down. Really appreciate it. He's just jumped into a class, the 7:30 Performance Club class. So if you hear him coughing, it's probably just the assault bike. So how are you, mate?
Good, mate. Thanks for having me. Yeah, definitely tested me that class there.
There you go. He'll be coughing all
the...
Oh,
God, it's been lingering for a while. And yeah, as you said, the assault bike doesn't help too much.
No, mate, it doesn't. How did the class go?
Yeah, it was awesome. I said to you before, the facility you've built here is amazing. Everyone jumping in together and that group fitness atmosphere is awesome. And yeah, I loved it. I haven't done much for the last couple of weeks, just sort of been nursing this cough a bit. But yeah, it wakes you up in the morning and feel good after. It's always about that, get moving and feel better after.
That's the first session you've done in a couple of weeks after being sick. I'm telling you, when I've had a few days off and I've got to do one of these classes, I'm usually laying on the floor for a good... 15 minutes after, so we'll see how you go.
I had my time to recover, so half an hour, it's good.
It's a little bit of a background on Alex. Xavier College, drafted to the Swans 2010, 47 games over 8 years, a number of knee injuries, ACL, owner of a cycle studio now in Malvern. Is that right, Malvern?
I've just moved it on, actually.
So really?
Yeah, last couple of months. Just
been,
been working through that, so...
Yep.
Yeah, just figuring out the next move.
Yeah, nice. Husband and newly father, an advocate for men's health in with Movember. So I guess we'll start off with, because your journey in terms of, I guess, AFL, I guess, I mean, from life is quite extraordinary. And there's been a lot documented on your AFL journey over the period of time. And I mean, from an outside point of view, seeing in and playing with you for, again, in the under 18s and I mean 16 to sort of 18, it's been unreal, I guess, to see your journey and how you've dealt with it all. So let's start off with Xavier College, about your schooling experience. How did you find, being in a private school and, education, was that big for you? Was a parent sort of pushed on that? Did you go to uni? Give us a bit of a background on that.
Yeah, definitely. No, I love my time at Xavier. I had an older brother, a couple of years older than me, that went, and he probably wasn't that fond of the school experience, I suppose, but I loved it. I think the opportunities that Xavier give you, particularly for me from a sporting point of view, is massive. My old man's huge in education. He's a lawyer by trade. He's retired now, but loved his studies and went to Melbourne Uni and was big on that for us three kids. I've got an older brother and older sister. So education was a massive priority for him. Probably not so much for me. I didn't mind it. I was a reasonable student at school, but yeah, my big focus was to get drafted and play AFL, I suppose, and Xavier definitely give you those opportunities. So was really fortunate to be able to go through that. I've still got a lot of close mates from Xavier, and as you know, going to St Kevin's, similar school, the networks you build through those schools is huge. I'm still involved in Old Xavier's Footy Club, and it's a huge network that you can really utilise and make the most of, I suppose. So it was great for me. In terms of study, I went on to do a business degree at uni, so I just ticked that over while I was at Sydney, and walked out with a uni degree as well, which is a positive from an AFL career.
How did you go with school footy, Oakley Chargers? Was there competition there? We had a few scenarios where, school wanted us to play for school and TSC Cup wanted us to try out for Vic Metro, and there was a fair bit of going on back and forth about that sort of school relationship. How did you find that with Oakley Chargers?
I was lucky, actually. I finished school when I was 17. So I had a year completely dedicated to under-18s footy, which probably helped me get drafted. I think if I was doing the two at the same time, probably wouldn't have got the exposure I did. To finish school at 17, and then went on to Captain Oakley in my under 18 year, and had a full year where I could dedicate to that. So I think that made a massive difference for me. Gave me a bit of exposure, I suppose, playing as a 17 year old or playing as a 13, 14 year old. I was always playing a year ahead effectively with the guys I was going to school with. So I think it gave you a bit of exposure. Some guys develop quicker than others at that age. So to have that exposure as a young kid, I think was awesome. And then to go on and have a full year at Oakley and be able to really concentrate on my under 18 stuff and Vic Metro, and did uni while I was doing that and worked. I think that sort of set me up for a successful start to an AFL career as well, actually to sort of grow up a little bit and figure out time management skills and things like that, which you probably don't get much at school.
So would you say, like, looking back on it now, because I know one of my best mates, Ben Casley, is exactly the same. So he finished a year before and had a whole year to do exactly what you just did, where I was playing at school and had that school trying to get drafted in that year. So, I mean, look back on it now, definitely a positive, playing as a younger, I guess, school footy, but then having the whole year to dedicate towards, like, how did you go about that year then? Did you fully train? Like, was it different compared to what you would have done? Like, did you go to uni that year? You went to uni that year?
Yeah, I went to uni that year. Yeah, full time.
Yeah.
I sort of tapered off towards the back end of the year. I think I dropped out halfway through the second semester because I thought I want to, properly concentrate on getting drafted, and that was the focus. But, yeah, I think just having different things to put your energy into. I worked just a casual job as well. And, I think it was a massive positive. I think there's a huge argument. There's a lot of discussion around should they raise the draft age, and what happens over in WA. Majority of guys who get drafted finish school the year before, so they have a full year of under-18s, and I think there's a huge argument for that. As I said, I probably wouldn't have ended up where I did if I had been doing the two at the same time.
So you reckon they should lift the draft age?
Yeah, I think they should. I think a similar system to, obviously not as intense as what the Americans do with the college system, but I think there's definitely merit in having an under-19s competition that guys go and play after school and just have that year to mature a bit. I think you mature a hell of a lot in that first year out of school rather than, sort of being spoon-fed everything for 13 years effectively from prep to year 12. So to be able to have that year to figure your life out a little bit and, make decisions on your own, I reckon can have a huge, positive impact.
It was funny. I was going through some research about you and about the under-18s, and I went through a bit of an old team list of the Vic Metro under-18s, and far out, some of the photos of us were just like, just crazy. We look like we're about 13 now.
It's amazing.
And just, I guess, I was going through this, the players of our team, of the under-18s national side, and just the amount of people that got drafted in that year. And then I guess from there where they've ended up, like some people are still playing, majority haven't. And I guess we'll talk about this after, but I don't know, we'll talk about it now. So I guess the perception of getting drafted and wanting to play AFL and thinking it's going to be a career that you stay in for 10 years and play 300 games and stuff, I know, from Nikki's background, my partner, her dad played 150 games. She's been surrounded by Brad Johnson, Roland Smith, both played 300 games. Do you know what I mean? It's their life. But that's not how AFL football is. The amount of people who are in and out of the system in 3 years. Do you know what I mean? If you're playing 5 years in an AFL system, you're doing pretty well. That's well above average. And then people who are playing 8 years like yourself and stuff like that, like that's it's not unheard of, but it's very much like in and out of the system unless you're a very stable player. Like I look at the players in that draft and not many of them are still playing at all.
They'd be probably and 3 or 4, wouldn't they?
Yeah, yeah, do you know what I mean? And even like just the people who in the career they had, like probably the one I looked at really briefly, like Andrew Gaff and all the, but like a lot of them in or out of the system. So what are they doing right now? Where like you look at it as an 18-year-old and like I want to play AFL, it's gonna be my career. I'm gonna be playing every week at the MCG in front of 80,000. I'm gonna be just training, kicking a footy. But then you look at it and the perception of that is totally, totally off.
Oh, absolutely. I think you just said it then. I think the average career is 3 or 4 years. So, if you looked at it and the amount of time people dedicate into getting into the system and then what they finish up at 21, 22, it's not a really, that's not a really retiring age of 60 like most careers are. So it is interesting. And I think, from your point of view, we, as kids, we grew up with exactly the same goal and, it doesn't work out like that. And you, I think, perspective's been a massive thing for me, and I think your goals, you've got certain goals at 15, 16 of where you want to get to, but they just continually shift, and mine shifted throughout my career from different setbacks I had and different things I wanted to achieve. You're reevaluating and readjusting your goals all the time to within achievable things, I suppose, but Yeah, you look at it now, like even guys I got drafted with at Sydney, I think, you know, Luke Parker's the only one left, really. And he's sort of coming towards the back end anyway. You get to that 28, 29, and, you know, if you're playing after 30, like, as you said, you're doing incredibly well. Yeah. So it is an interesting one. It's not well documented.
Mm.
There's an interesting, I suppose, there's a lot of guys that write memoirs or books about their AFL career, but one that, you know, really resonates with me, and he's a good mate of mine, Brandon Jack. If you haven't read his book gives a really interesting perspective on what it's like, and particularly from his point of view, he looked, you know, followed in the footsteps of his brother, who I'm really close with, Kieran, as well, but was co-captain of the footy club, and, you know, played 250, you know, whatever games it was, really successful career, and Brandon thought, that's how my career will pan out, and as you said, majority of the time it doesn't. It is really interesting how how it happens for people and how different pathways are formed, I suppose, for every individual and whatever career path they choose or you know how things pan out. It's interesting looking back now. And as I said, it was, you know, what is it, 14 years ago since we played. 13 or 14 years ago since we played that under 18 stuff. It seems like a lifetime now. It's amazing.
I know. So tell me, you get drafted to Sydney, move out, from the suburbs of Melbourne. How did you go? Did you move in with another player's family?
Yeah, Sydney always had a housing program. So I moved in with a couple of boys. Moved in with Max Otten. Do you remember, him? Yeah, so Max got rookied after me. So I moved in with him and then another guy, Dan Curry, who ended up playing at North and Gold Coast after. He'd been there for 4 or 5 years, but in saying that, he'd been there for 5 years and never played. Like, he never played a senior game for Sydney. So it's pretty interesting. But moving in with them, it was it's different. I sort of was very much a homebody growing up. I love Melbourne, love my really close family, close mates, and things like that. So moving to Sydney was definitely an adjustment, and it's pretty quick turnaround. You get drafted on the Thursday, and you're on a plane a few days later, and suitcase and see you later. This is your new life. It's pretty surreal, I suppose. But it was unbelievable to get to a city like that. And I love my time in Sydney. It was ended up being sort of 8.5 years living up there, and I absolutely loved it. It's a great city and great sort of balance between city and beach. And I absolutely love my time up there.
Just before we go on to, the grand final and stuff like that, and building your career there, pick number 57 of the draft. You would have just been like me on that night, just hoping that your name gets called out. You see some of the players that we're playing with in the Vic side, or people we've played against in the other states, get called out. Do you get a bit nervous? Do you get like how were you? Did you know you were getting picked up by them? What was the communication like?
Not a huge amount. Same as you. I think same as probably. Yeah, there'd probably be 500 kids sitting around the country hoping that their name gets called out. I'd had a lot of contact from Sydney. I'd probably met with them 3 times, they checked in a lot. I'd had an ankle little stabilisation surgery done probably 3 or 4 weeks before the draft, and they'd kept tabs on that probably 2 or 3 times. So I knew that they were pretty keen, but they hold their cards pretty close to their chest, all the clubs. So you're never really sure. And, I think the Bulldogs said, if you're there at 74, we'll definitely take you. They said that to 6 guys.
Yeah.
You only take one guy with it.
Yeah.
Remember they said that to a few mates, and it's like, you can't promise. You just can't promise those things. So I was confident, but you never really know. And, sitting around with the family, I remember it distinctly. Dad, as I said, loved his education, big numbers man. He was like, what's your draft idea? I said, I don't know. We'll have our name. Anyway, he's losing it because there was another kid from the NT that got drafted and his name was Alex Johnson. He's like, they might have fucked it up. What's your number? I'm like, oh, God. So I've got him yelling at me. And finally it happened. And I was like, look, the reality, if they've stuffed it up, they'll call. It'll actually get sorted anyway. Stress was heightened. But, it's one of the great. It was bittersweet. I've got mum there, burst into tears as soon as it happens, knowing that her youngest kid's moving away, I suppose. It's an unbelievable moment. It's the strangest way you'd ever find out you've got a job, I suppose, is from the banner that runs across the bottom of the screen. They don't even announce it when you get into the late 50s. No one really cares. It's all about the top 10 and that's it.
Yeah.
But, finding out and then, what ensues after that, just a massive sort of party and speak to Sydney and let's get into things straight away. For me, it was never... I didn't really care what number I went. I was never about that. It was more I just wanted the opportunity to get there, and I knew once I got on a list, then I'd be able to, get to where I wanted to get to as quick as I could. So, it is pretty surreal though. But yeah, for every kid that does get drafted, there's probably three or four that miss out, and it's definitely a weird time, and it's a weird concept, I suppose, the whole draft process. You've got no idea where you're going, and sort of sign your life away, and off you go, I suppose.
Yeah, I know. It is a weird experience from my point of view. I didn't get drafted, and I'm hoping for the rookie. And I remember just on the draft night, didn't get called, so I literally just went for a swim straight away, trying to get my frustration out, thinking, like, what the fuck's going to happen with my life? Yeah. Like, then you're thinking about, like, where am I going to be playing? Like, you know what I mean? And then how am I going to try and get drafted again? And your whole life gets sort of thrown into a roller coaster.
At that age as well, it's probably more about the outside perception as well. You'd have a, close network and then extended network saying, Dill's going to get drafted and all this. And then it's like, oh, what happened? You're like, fuck, I don't know.
Yeah, I know.
I'm not making the decision. So I think once you get older, you realise that outside noise doesn't actually matter. But at 17, 18, it's everything.
Especially school, you know what I mean? Like 100%. Like for me, you had Mitch and Libber, like they were definitely going to get father-son. And then, you know what I mean? It was like, Dill's definitely going to get drafted. And then it doesn't happen. It's just bang. Yeah. It's just thrown.
And then you're all left to sort of pick up the pieces and explain why. And how can you do that? Like, you can't really make sense of it, I suppose. So, strange one.
So let's go fast forward a couple of years later, playing in an AFL Grand Final. You're 20 years old. Did I look back at some of the footage of you playing before and it was just like, you look so young.
Oh, mate, I see it every now and then. And I'm like, oh God, my partner now. We haven't been together for that long, but we sort of knew each other growing up and whatever. And she's like, you look about 10.
I know.
Playing. And looking back, I definitely did. At the time, you just don't feel it. It just had rolled on naturally, I suppose. Lucky enough to play 20 games my first year and then play every game in that 2012 season, which I probably didn't expect as a late pick and pretty skinny kid when I went in, inhibited by an ankle too. So I didn't train for the first probably 3 months up there.
So the first year... Yep. You played how many games?
20 games.
20 games in your first year, which is unheard of.
Yeah.
And then the second year, you played every game.
Yeah.
So you played,
45 games.
45 out of your 47 games in the first 2 years.
Yeah, when you say that at the start, you go 8 years, 47 games, it doesn't sound like great return. But when you go 2 years, 45 games, that sounds like great return.
Far out.
It's from going averaging 22 and a half games a year to what about eight? Six.
So grand final... The memories of that, is it a blur or is it?
It is and it isn't. I suppose there are things, it's 11 years ago now. Like we had our 10-year reunion last year. It seems amazing that it sort of feels like yesterday, but it feels like 100 years ago at the same time.
Yep.
It's everything you sort of can imagine and more, I suppose. I was lucky enough to grow up, in a pretty heavily footy family. Like my parents go to every grand final, I reckon. We're MCC members through and through. Dad. He's a MCG tour guide now. He just loves it. So just absolute sport nut family. Went to every sporting event that ever came to Melbourne, travelled the world going to sporting events and things like that. So really, really fortunate to do that. But I'd been to a lot of grand finals. And as a kid, you sort of think, how good would it be to play there? But you sort of never think it's ever going to happen, I suppose. Mm. And, I sort of recall the conversation I had to mum when I was, I think, about 10 or something. We were talking about tattoos. And she was like, you'll never get a tattoo. I said, if I win an AFL grand final or run the Olympics. And she's like, well, sweet, he's never going to do all that. So sure enough, that ensued after. But, it was amazing, the whole build-up. I think being in Sydney for my career was a, absolute blessing. You're out of the limelight. You can live a life. 30 of us could get together on the weekend and go to the pub and carry on a bit. No one really cared. And I think that's why the bond was so close with all the players.
Yeah, because you can't do that here. Can't go anywhere.
Speak to, a mate of mine, Tommy Mitchell, sort of started his career in Sydney, then comes down to Hawthorn. Obviously now he's at Collingwood, even a bigger club, but I think went out a few times in his first little bit at Hawthorn and was like, this is just ridiculous. You can't do anything. So up there, we were really lucky with that. But also the fact that not many of us are from New South Wales. So I think in that 2012 year, I would have had dinner with probably... There was a group of five or six or seven of us that would have had dinner four nights a week, I reckon. So you're spending a hell of a lot of time together.
Mm.
And that just, builds that trust and builds the confidence in each other to be able to go out and execute what we wanted to do. And, heavy underdogs in that grand final. But there was just a sense of belief, I suppose. Even going into the final series, we lost three out of the last four. And every game was sort of within a goal or two. And I remember sort of reviewing it. And as a kid, you're sort of like... They don't really affect you that much. You think that this is going to happen all the time. I played a couple of finals in my first year and then you think it's going to happen all the time.
Yeah.
Whereas you got guys like Reece Shaw, a really close mate of mine, that had played in the grand final in 2002, lost, and then hadn't got back there till 10 years later. So, yeah. At that age, you probably take it for granted. And, yeah, I remember we won the qualifying final over in Adelaide, flew back, and I remember saying to Jared McVeigh, I was like, mate, we're on holidays. We've got 2 weeks off. And he's like, we're not fucking on holidays. We've got the biggest game of your life coming up, like prelim against Collingwood.
Yeah.
What ended up being Collingwood, but... You just take it in your stride, and it was just such great fun. I've got such fond memories of that time, and then, you know, to go on and do what we did was just unbelievable.
Amazing. You won the Rising Star 2012 that year.
Yeah, with Sydney. I was disappointed I didn't win it in my first year, actually. That's sort of, talk about that perspective piece. I was like, oh, I've come in first year, played 20 games, more than most draftees, but... Yeah. Sam Reid won it. He'd only played one game in his first year. So similar rules to the AFL one. You sort of, if you're under 21 or you've only played a certain amount of games. Those expectations started to shift pretty quickly. You walk in the doors as an 18-year-old kid in November and go, all I want to do is just play one game and then I'm happy. And then as soon as you play, you're like, I want to keep going. And, that 2012 season just couldn't have panned out better, really. It was incredible.
So then tell me how life changes then, 2013 preseason game, did your first ACL?
Yep.
I've done an ACL as well, and just the feeling straight away, it just like, you know, you're in for a long road to recover.
Yep.
How did you go mentally straight away? How did you do it? Was it change of direction, jumping, landing?
Yeah, it was just, as you said, it was a preseason game. I'd done the whole preseason, which is the first probably full preseason you do. First couple of years, you nurse through a little bit and they look after your body. And then I did that. And I remember I'd played 100% of the first couple of preseason games. I was like, I need to get ready for a proper season here. I need a bit of a break. And then, just against Gold Coast out of Blacktown, one of the worst grounds in Sydney. It's about an hour from the city. There's about three people out there watching. And just changed the direction. I went to tackle Jago Mira and stepped off my left, and it just gave way. And as you know, doing your ACL, it's a weird feeling. I heard this great sort of pop and, excruciating pain for probably 30 seconds. And then I was like, oh, no, I'll be right. No, I went to get up and walk, and they were like, no, we want to practice our stretcher protocols. And I was like, come on, I'm going to look like a pussy. Just let me walk off. Anyway, they put me on the stretcher. And then in the rooms, one-on-one with the doc, and he's like, yeah, you've done your ACL. And I turned 21 the week before, and I was like, what does that mean? I'd had ankle injuries that had last 1 or 2 weeks growing up, but never anything, and then he sort of, an ACL, and I knew, obviously the media coverage around, it was really big at that time. I think a lot of guys had done it in 2012, so you sort of knew about it. And then in that preseason, 2013, I think 11 guys did it within a 3 or 4 week period across the competition. So it was sort of the buzz injury at that time, and I was sort of unfortunate enough to get struck by it. But it's a weird one. I was jumping around in the rooms, running, and I said to the doc, no, you're wrong. Just let me go back out there. He's like, you've definitely done it. Your knee's loose. And I was like, but I can do everything.
Yeah.
So it's just bizarre. And
it's a weird one, isn't it?
It's just ridiculous. As I said, the pain's excruciating for that 30-second period, and then you feel just normal again. Mm. So, and then what happens after? You go and get a scan the next day, and it's like, yeah, righto, you're out. For me, I thought, 12 months, not a huge amount of time, and being as sort of impatient as I was like, I'll prove it wrong and try and get back earlier. And then, things just went from bad to worse, I suppose, with different complications, with surgeries going wrong. And, it didn't pan out the way I would have liked. 12 months turned into 5.5 years pretty quickly. So
the first ACL, we had infections, or is it had infections straight away?
That's what they think. There's not really an answer. I mean, the medical profession is one of those things that, everything's set on precedence, and it's all about what has happened previously. Yeah. And this had never really happened to many people, that an infection was in there that was being so damaging but never really showed up in bloods or on scans or anything like that. So, first one had done in March 2013. So just a couple of weeks after I'd done the initial injury, 3 months, 3.5 months, got back running as you usually do, and then it just blew up. Things weren't right. So came back down to see the surgeon, had that surgery in Melbourne. Came back down to see him. He did a scope on me. I wake up and he says, the ACL's not attached. It hasn't worked. I'm like, what do you fucking mean it hasn't worked? that's the last thing you want to hear when you wake up from surgery. You're already compromised because of the meds you've been put on and whatever. So I just lost it. Got up, walked out, and was like, righto, I'm going to go and do Lars, which is the quick ACL, which I'd sort of contemplated at the start as I said before, 21-year-old in a rush. I wanted to get back. We're going to compete for the next couple of flags, I would have thought, so I wanted to be involved in that. And then I had a Lars procedure done not long after that. So put a synthetic ligament in with what was in the ACL, but it was never right. In a healthy knee joint, you're meant to have about 2 to 5 mil of fluid. I was getting about 150 mil drained on a weekly basis. Looking back, probably wasn't the best thing to do, but you're just doing whatever you can to get up and go. And
so the first Rico was a hamstring graft I took?
Yeah, hamstring graft. Okay. Yeah, which is almost worse. Anyone that's had one, it's worse than the actual knee. It's the worst hamstring tear you've ever had. They've gone in and, I made the mistake of actually watching what they do in the surgery. Yeah. Jesus Christ.
No, it's not good, is it?
It's like a hacksaw. I remember
looking at it as well. They start hammering it. 100%.
And I'm like, yeah, and it's, YouTube's a terrible thing. Even before the op, I started looking at what they do. And you think surgeons are delicate people. No, they're absolutely not. No wonder you got so much trauma and bruising around the area. It's just ridiculous. But, so I had a hamstring graft. So you compromise with that as well, but... I got through the full pre-season leading into the 2014 season, I suppose, and I was going to play we had a practice match before round one against Brisbane, and I was going to play that, and Horse just sort of said, oh, we'll just give you another week. So he did. So then I played twos in a curtain raiser before round one, just in a practice match, and, 9 or 10 minutes in, I'd had a really good 10 minutes, and it seems insignificant, but that gave me a huge amount of confidence that I could still... You're sort of never sure. I mean, I'd only missed 12 months, but you're still never sure whether you can play at the level.
So
I'd missed, it was a year and like 6 days or something that I'd actually missed playing. Had a sort of good 9-10 minutes, and then, just jumped and landed, and it just went. And, as people would know, in terms of if you've got fluid in any part of your body, it disrupts the signals that it sends to your brain, so your muscles aren't activating properly. So that's what happened, and collapsed underneath me, and that was it. And then you fake, and then we're sort of like, what's actually going on here? So I suppose that was the catalyst to have a bit more of a look in terms of what was wrong with the knee, and what was genuinely going on.
Because I guess, definitely in the AFL, like you never hear of it. Like you hear of someone doing maybe an ACL twice. Like I've had a mate do it 3 times, but never like consistently. Infections, what's going on, Lars, trying all these different things, getting back, full pre-season, and then doing it again. How was that? Like, because I mean, doing one, like I was fully invested in my rehab. I'm like, I'm going to be back in 6.5 months. Like, it sort of changed when I did it in 2015, I think it was, 2014. It changed from like a 12-month injury to like, okay, there's people getting back in 6 months now if you do everything right. Like 6 to 8 was like the normal time frame, but so I was like, "Fuck, I'm going straight in here. Do whatever you tell me to do, I'll do it."
Yeah.
Like, how do you do that like nonstop? Like, I guess shit, I got to do this again. Like, for me, like I don't know how I could comprehend that.
Yeah, I'm similar to you in terms of what was coming out of the States, all the data coming out of there. I think there was a bloke that got back playing NFL in 3.5 months or something. It was something ridiculous from a traditional, and I was like, righto, if he can do that, and then you look at. Tyson Goldsack got back in 2018, I think in 6 months or whatever, to play in that grand final.
Yeah.
So you're definitely looking at how I can get an advantage here and how I can quicken this time up. And I suppose that was my decision with going with Lars a couple of times. I think having Nick Malcheski pretty close, a close mate of mine, he'd been through it and got back in 11 weeks.
Yeah, for a final year, is that right?
It was my first year.
Yeah.
I think. So I he was that. My mentor in my first year, and he went down. I think he'd done one previously in 06 or something like that. Had a traditional and then did a Lars. And, it was 11 and a half weeks he played again. And he just wanted to get – he was back end of his career. He wanted to sort of get as much out as he could. And, I mean, we wouldn't have won that 2012 flag without him. So, I'm bloody glad that he did do that. But seeing that, I was like, right, if he can do that, then can't I? It was just underpinned by infection. I suppose for me a lot of that time was in limbo as well. I had a lot of – that 5.5 year period where I didn't have an ACL in and then was just pumped full of antibiotics. I look back now, I was taking 12 to 14 tablets a day, 3 times a day. I saw some know, some infection, some of the best infectious disease specialists in the country, I suppose, got their advice on what I should do, and that was it. It was sort of, there was nothing clear in terms of what the infection was. They put it down to some sort of staff, but it was never, I look back and I wish it was like golden staff that had killed me. At least they would have been able to find out what it was, get on top of it and then clear it out. It was this bug, and, you know, they're looking at it now, they're sort of incredibly smart. These bugs, they lay dormant when they can, and then, you know, if something's disrupted with surgeries, which obviously I had a lot of them, I had 12 surgeries on that left knee, then they jump back into action and start causing havoc again. So, there was a lot of period there where I was in limbo, and, you know, you're sitting there on antibiotics. I was in and out of hospital a lot. I spent 4 weeks in hospital at one point on IV antibiotics, and you just, like, mentally, I don't know, I look back on it now and sort of think, oh, I couldn't do that. But at the time, you just I was so doggedly determined to get back and play. I just wanted to. So I was just, whatever I've got to do, I'll just do. But yeah, sitting in there, when you're pretty much able-bodied, you can walk around and do everything. Sitting there in a hospital bed, it's a miserable place to be. Hospitals are not good places at all. Even I get, you know, even going there, I've got a 3-month-old now, going to hospital. Then we stayed in hospital for 3 nights, and after one night, I was like, all right, let's go. Come on, Zoe. And she's like, no, I want to stay in here. I sort of get anxious in them. I just don't like them just because of what I've been through. And
yep.
I mean, there's not 90% of the time you go in a hospital for a negative reason rather than a positive. I mean, the birth of my child was, you know, the greatest thing in my life. But there's just the underlying thing of what hospitals mean to me. And I'm not a fan of them at all. So I had to get out every couple of hours. I was like, righto, you right here. I need to go for a walk and, you know, do something different. But I think, you know, mentally it just compounded over the years and probably took its toll when I'd finished rather than at the time.
Yep.
I think it probably takes a toll on people around you a lot more. Like, you know, my mum, for example, she's my greatest supporter ever. Unbelievable mother to us three kids growing up. But when I was going through my stuff, she was just unwavering, you know, an absolute rock in terms of pillar of support for me, was at every surgery, was there whenever I needed her. And yeah, the toll it took on her at the time was probably massive. And then when I kept saying, no, I want to get back and play, she's probably like, can you just not? But never once did she show me that. I mean, the impact that it's had on her in terms of her sort of enjoyment of footy has been massive, I reckon. She does, you know, she just doesn't like the game because of what it did to me.
Yep.
But yeah, I suppose you just sort of put your head down and try and get through it as best you can.
Just on that with your mum and about how the impact it's had on football. Is it the same with you? Do you watch footy now?
Yeah, I do. It took me a while to get back there. I think early days in that sort of 2013 when things went a bit pear-shaped, 2014, I just didn't want anything to do with it. I'd train, I'd do all the right things, but I'd often just train on my own.
Yeah.
And I'd say to the club were really good with me in understanding. They knew I knew how to work. They knew I'd do all the right things, but I didn't like being around the boys. There was a lot of time. You look back on that, and that was probably, you know, my mental health kicking in, going, I don't want to have another conversation about this. Because the worst thing is you can walk in and people go, how are you going? And you're like, yeah, I'm good. But deep down, you're like, I'm shit ass. Like, my knee's fucked. I don't know when I'm going to get back. I don't know if I'm going to get back. And you just don't want to have that conversation all the time.
Yeah, non-stop.
Non-stop. So I'd either get in there early or get in late, do my stuff and then get out. Like, you know, I didn't want to, you know, they try and involve you in the footy program as much as you can, but the reality is you've got, you know, if it's a fit list, you've got 44 guys going out and playing on the weekend and you're not. Like, it's a pretty isolating experience. And I think going through that, 2013, there were a few other guys that went down. So you sort of have those guys to be able to train with and go through things with, and you create strong bonds with them. But still, you're just jealous and you're envious of the guys that actually get to run around the weekend. And there's a lot. Sydney have got a really good culture in terms of every player that's not playing, if they've gone and played reserves or they haven't played at all, will go to the ones. Whereas I don't think a lot of other clubs do. It was almost compulsory unless you had a good excuse. But there's a few times where I just said, I don't want to. Like, I just can't do this. I'd prefer to stay away. So it was probably a positive and negative for me, just disengaging from the group. And I reckon, it took me probably 2 or 3 years to come to terms with the fact that I wasn't actually going to play on the weekend. And that takes its toll as well. I reckon it affects your relationships a fair bit.
Were you talking to anyone back then? at the club, or like, you know what I mean, not, psychs or anything like that?
Not really. No, we had a psych at the club, but I didn't really get along with him. I thought he was a bit just not overly engaged with the group. There was a few sort of signs, and I was like, and probably for me back then, I was embarrassed to say, yeah, you know, I'm struggling here. Because, you know, you'd have moments of clarity and perspective, and you'd think, oh, it's a sore knee, it's not ridiculous. And even outside, people would be like, fuck, how good is it? You get paid to do nothing. And it's like, that's the furthest thing from the truth. Mm. Like, you know, if you feel, and it goes back to that outside noise, what you're focusing on back then when I was, you know, 21, 22, 23, you've got, lucky I wasn't at a Melbourne club, you know, being in Sydney, you're sort of away from it a bit, but, you know, news had come out that I was going back in for surgery, or I needed another recall, or whatever was going on, and people would be like, you know, he's a waste of money and all this stuff. And you're like, you can't help but sort of read into that a little bit. And then you start sort of questioning what you're actually doing. As I said, I was really lucky being away from it in terms of being in Sydney and having the full support of the club. You know, they kept me contracted the whole time. There was one period at the end of 2017 where they delisted me and sort of said, you're done. And I had to fight for something, but... I was really lucky in terms of the support I had. But in terms of communicating, I think I've become a much better communicator in terms of what I'm going through now, post-footy. And, yeah, I think back then I don't know whether it was pride or whether it was sort of lack of emotional intelligence, I reckon there was a lot of that too. And immaturity in terms of what it means to put your hand up and say, yeah, I'm actually struggling, and how much it can help.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's in the last few years, that's definitely changed my life. To be able to say, yeah, I'm struggling, and unpack all that. And, yeah, since coming out, I've seen a couple of psychs. I've had a psych for sort of 18 months now, which I see. And, you know, I haven't caught up with him for a couple of months now. It's sort of one of those things that you might need a period of time where you need to see him every week or whatever it looks like, and then you can have a bit of time of clarity and just figure things out on your own. But that's seriously affected my life in such a, you know, positive way, I suppose, to be able to unpack what went on and how it took its toll and how it affected me.
I guess you hit the nail on the head there with sometimes, I guess, people go and they'll have the vulnerability to go chat to someone, but then they might not connect with that person, and then they might not do it again, or they might not try and find someone else. Do you know what I mean? It may take 3 or 4 people to go through until you find someone you actually trust, who you actually feel comfortable talking to, and that you can start to unpack it. Do you know what I mean? The first experience you had, say at Sydney, that person wasn't the right fit for you, and then you don't go to someone. Do you know what I mean? So it can take a few times to find the right person. And I guess that's having the awareness of going, okay, that's all right, that person wasn't right for me. Okay, now I've got to try and find someone else.
Yeah, I've no doubt about it. And I think when you're going through something like mental health, or when you're going through a challenging time, being vulnerable once takes everything. And if it doesn't work out, you sort of, you know, you're fucked really. Your back's against the wall and you go, right, it just doesn't work for me. Whether that's professional or, you know, just someone that you'd speak to and it doesn't resonate, or you feel judged or whatever, and no doubt about it. I reckon over the journey now, I would have spoken to probably 5 or 6 psychs, and a couple of them you sort of click with. Couple, you know, I was like, he just doesn't understand where I'm coming from or doesn't resonate. And it wasn't vital that the person I spoke to had been involved in footy, but it was very important to me that they had an understanding of it.
Mm.
And, you know, the guy that I've seen recently, he actually worked in footy previously, so that helps, obviously. Yep. No longer does and hasn't for a few years now, but gets the whole... Because it's a very different beast than sort of everyday life, I suppose. Yeah. It's a very, you know, insular...
Bubble.
Bubble and high-performance industry that not many people would understand, I suppose, unless you've been in it at any level, really.
Yep.
So I think that was really important for me. But you're spot on in terms of, I mean, even people that I've spoken to, they're like, yeah, I saw a psych once, I didn't really get along with it, so I gave up. And it's like, the amount of people that do that, particularly now, because it's bloody hard to see one.
Yeah.
Especially after the last few years, you know, getting into one might take you 6 months. And then if that person doesn't work out, then what do? Wait another 6 months. And then before you know it, it's been 2 years and you haven't found someone you get along with. It's bloody hard.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
So let's talk about, so you've gone through all that preparation. We've got back 2018. I watched when they announced that you were going to be playing your first game back after, 5.5 years?
Yeah.
All those surgeries. You play your first game. Just, I guess, the emotion of you looked just over the moon. I was seeing the highlights and stuff like that. And then, so that's your first game back in 5.5 years. You're at the biggest high of high, getting back to, you didn't think you're probably going to play again, or, do you know, I mean, keep contracted for that whole time, get back to play. And then the week after, you do your ACL and the MCG, same place you did it the first time. Is that right? No,
I did it out at Blacktown. But sorry, it was the first time I'd been back there since the grand final.
Do your ACL against Melbourne, your other leg. And I watched the, because the recap was, it was an important game for Sydney, that game. And you knew that you'd done it. And your mum come down, and there was a few photos and that sort of stuff.
Yep.
And yet at quarter time, you went out there, and I don't know how you did it, but the leadership to go out there and get around all your players, even though you know that you're pretty much stuffed, to get around to everyone and not show that, because you know from a team point of view, especially in an important game like that, during a game, emotions are high, and you go out there and your bloody, really emotional that you've done your ACL again. The boys are going to be, devastated for you.
Yeah.
You see what people are like when people get injured and stuff like that. And yet you go out there and show your leadership, and then you go down after the rooms after the first quarter, and that's when it sort of comes to the realization that, it could be over. You've done your ACL again. How did you go about getting through that sort of period of going, shit, I've got to pull myself together here and show some leadership?
Yeah.
It's very much, I spoke about in the last podcast where I got injured, nothing like, from what you did, but in the run, and I had to sort of pick myself up to make sure the boys got around their last day, even though I was fucking shattered that I couldn't be finishing it. And you just got to be, totally just not about yourself at all.
Yeah.
How did you go about that?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I don't know. I suppose I'd had pretty good practice over the sort of 5.5, 6 years of hiding what I was actually going through. I think you speak about the elation playing against Collingwood. Probably 6 to 8 months earlier, I probably didn't think that was actually going to come. I was kept contracted the whole time except for 2017. They delist me, sort of say you're the furthest player that's ever going to play on this list. And I was like, right, I went in and then I had to fight. I'd played sort of 8 or 9 reserves games and then I had to fight for a contract, just fight for another year, really. So then they ended up rooking me, which I was lucky. But then had another, had groin surgery in February of that 2018 year, so missed sort of 6 to 8 weeks with that. Finally got back and played. And then, as you said, it was really important. We'd lost a couple of games in a row, I reckon. I thought I was a chance for the Essendon game. Didn't get picked and then started to get filthy. And I was like, righto, this is what it feels like. It was just sort of that sense of normality of being a footballer again.
Yeah.
I was really lucky my first couple of years, never got dropped, once I got in the team. Missed a couple of games through injury my first year, but just straight back in every time.
Yeah.
So they sort of, I established myself as a, picked every week player, which is unlikely really in those early years, but
yeah,
really lucky that they gave me the confidence. And then, the elation of Collingwood, we won by 2 points. It was just unbelievable. And then the next week, the highs and lows of footy, I definitely saw that in an 8-day period. You really figure out what it's all about. And going down with my good knee in Melbourne, you just gather yourself, I suppose. I knew that it was the first time I'd done an ACL on a big stage. It was a big game for Melbourne. It was a big game for us. It was a big crowd at the MCG. And I just think I know what's going on. What's happened, and then you just sort of lie to a few of the guys. I told a few close mates on the bench that, I'd definitely done it, but don't worry about it. Like, we need to win this game. And Nick Smith went down with a hamstring, actually, which ended up being his last game too. He sort of battled on for another couple of years to try and play, but never quite got there. You just go out, and I just knew that if I could keep a brave face, I'd just keep the guys concentrated on what we needed to do. And, I'm not saying that, if I didn't do that, we wouldn't have won or whatever, but I just didn't want them to be sidetracked at all. And I knew how important it was. And that's sort of the beauty of footy, I suppose, is that it is what you're trying to achieve and what you want to do is it's bigger than the individual. And and that sort of sums it up in that moment, I suppose, just going out and making sure everyone was switched on to what we needed to do. And, I remember speaking, I'd go into a Lear and he was going to take Jesse Hogan and, Jesse's lateral movement for a big guy was unbelievable. That's why I did my knee. So just speaking to Lear about in terms of how to go about that and whatever. And just concentrating on the footy side of things. And then once I went down to the rooms, then you can sort of, I suppose, let things out. And, you know, it was a pretty emotional sort of 20 minutes after that. My family came down to the rooms and you're just in there and it's like, righto, what now? Mm. And then, you know, we end up winning the game, which is brilliant. I came back out and Daisy Pierce asked me for an interview, which I've joked with her since. I was like, I can't believe you put a microphone in front of me. But that's her job and I was happy to do it. It, you know, it doesn't – I didn't give much. You know, it's everyone pretty much knew what had happened. So there was not much I could – you know, I couldn't shed too much light on what the situation was. But, it's a bizarre feeling. It's definitely bizarre. And, you know, there was a part of me that – you know, I knew deep down that was the last time I'd step onto an AFL field as a player. But there's a part of you that's like, nah, it's my good name. Maybe I could get back. Mm. But yeah, then everything sort of unfolds in the weeks to come.
When you look back on your career, your AFL career, I mean, you dreamt of playing AFL, you made it. When you look back on it, how do you recap it?
Now for a long time I saw it as a failure, and that was probably. That was probably the biggest issue I had was that negativity surrounding my AFL career and what I hadn't achieved, let alone what I had. And I think, you know, my mindset has always been, you know, I want to get the best out of myself and achieve as much as possible. And I sort of, for a long time I looked at it and thought, no, I didn't. And that sort of sent me into a spiral of negativity and of failure. There was a point probably when... Yeah, so I finished up in 2018. That was all said and done. You know, you get delisted. They offered me a coaching contract, but I wanted to come back to Melbourne. And sort of moving back, went through a bit of, you know, it's a big change, I suppose. I had a relationship breakdown then as well. And, just went into self-destruction mode a little bit. You start to think, you know, what's all this worth and all those things. And then, you know, gathered myself and, went and did a couple of things down here, and then probably when COVID hit, I reckon a lot of people were in a similar boat. But when COVID hit for me, it really gave me, it stopped everything. You know, I was sort of, even when I came back in 2019 and first bit of 2020, I was doing different things. I was involved in a few different organisations and coaching and playing at Carlton with their two side and doing a few other different things. And then 2020 hits, you know, March or whatever, the whole world's locked down. It gave me an opportunity to reflect a bit, and I probably went straight to the negative. And that's what I've, you know, over the last sort of couple of years I've been able to reevaluate. And I look back now and I'm, you know, I'm super proud of what I was able to achieve and you know, to walk away with, you know, a premiership, which everyone wants, is, you know, is unbelievable. You know, I would have never, and then to get back and play as well, I suppose. People are sort of like, you know, was it worth it in the end? And yeah, I think it was. I think just that one more time to play and prove that I could do it.
Yeah.
You know, sits really well with me. As I said, you know, even the start, you know, 8 years and 47 games, you look at that and you're like, that's not a great return.
Yeah.
But you know, the reality is one game is amazing, and that's all I wanted as a kid
Definitely.
And to play in one, you know, one of the, you know, best grand finals in the last, you know, 20 years or whatever, and to be able to come out on top of that is, yeah, I sit really comfortably with that now. But it's been a journey to get there. And I think that in terms of that whole love for footy and all those things, it does waver over the journey. But, you know, I'm back involved now coaching at, you know, just amateur level with the old Zavs, and I love it. I did some stuff with the school over the last 3 or 4 years, and working with those 16, 17-year-old kids, you're in their shoes once, and being able to help them on their journey is amazing. And there are guys that I've coached that have gone on to play AFL, and satisfaction you get watching these guys play, and you think, even if it was one small thing that I had an impact on it, you know, it's worth it. Because I remember coaches back when I was coming through at that age, and you know, whatever, if it was something they said to me or a drill or whatever it was, you're like, oh, I remember that and I took that on. So, being able to have that impact on the next generation is satisfying for me, and I think that sort of coaching thing is the next best thing. But I think I'll always be involved in footy, whether I look to get back involved at the professional level or whatever level it is. I've grown up loving it, and I think the love's still there for it.
So when you finish footy, come back here, what work, business, what was the, were you thrown in the deep end going, fuck, what am I going to do now?
Yeah, you definitely are. You know, I was, as I mentioned before, had a business degree and probably, in a more fortunate position than a lot of guys. A lot of guys come out, haven't studied and don't really know what they're going to do. And I mean, I was the same. I didn't know what I was going to do. There are opportunities in a few different fields. You know, footy was the big one. I had coaching offers from several clubs when I came out, but sort of wanted to make the decision to get out and do something different so I could sort of just see, as you said before, it's a pretty small bubble, footy, so go and sort of see something different. So I stayed involved in just a sort of part-time sort of role with the Northern Blues and Carlton and did some coaching there and ended up playing half of AFL season in that 2019 year and was going to play in 2020, but then COVID hit. And then, yeah, she sort of just, I was, you know, I didn't do much for that 2020 COVID time, probably 12 months there where I didn't do much. And then, yeah, got involved in a business, you know, similar to what you're doing in the health and fitness space, had a indoor cycling studio in Armidale and, yeah, got approached a little while ago for someone to sort of take it over, take their space over. It was, for me, it was never going to be, I never wanted to do it long term, I suppose. It was just, yeah, something to try, you know, run my own show and yep. I learned a hell of a lot. It probably didn't work out as well as I would have hoped. It was niche what we were doing and it's quite a fickle industry as you probably know. Mm. But yeah, I sit here and just trying to figure out what the next move is, whether it's, yeah, to look back and get involved in the footy side of things or sort of go more down business route. I'm not 100% sure yet, but there's definitely that sort of 3-5 month period when you do finish up and it's like, fuck, what do I do now? Mm. And there's that, you definitely feel that feeling of, you know, lost and that identity as well. You know, yep. My identity for a long time was football and then secondary was like the unlucky knee guy in football. I still have that tag, I think, you know, to probably be one of the unluckiest players that's ever played. But then, you know, over the last probably couple of years, my priorities have shifted too in terms of, you know, the resilience space and the mental health space is something that I am really keen on and looking to, yeah, potentially go down that path as well. I think, you know, from coaching kids over the last few years, you know, the amount of kids these days that are on anti-anxiety medication and things like that. And I mean, there was a period there where I tried it. I tried it for a couple of months and fuck me, it just changes everything. It changes your whole personality really and changes your whole life. And so I sort of got off that pretty quickly. But I know people that, you know, have been on that for 10 years and if that's the way they can sort of keep themselves level, you know, I understand it and there's definitely a space in this world for it. But I think when kids are starting it at 14 and 15 and it doesn't bode well for what the future looks like if they're going to be on it for an extended period of time. So something in that space, you know, I look at what like Hugh Van Collenberg's done with the Resilience Project and, those types of things. And, you know, look at what you guys are doing with Holler and the power of conversations is just massive. And I think for me, going down that space would be something that will give me that fulfillment and, you know, being able to help as many people as possible.
A couple more. So just had a baby 3 months ago. How's that all going? Changed life?
Yeah, no, it's going well. Yeah, speak about that perspective piece. You sort of, it's amazing. Over the last couple of weeks, she's getting more engaged and starting to react a little bit. And it's unbelievable. As I mentioned before, my partner Zoe, it's funny, we've known each other for about 15 years, I suppose, grew up together, just sort of similar schools. She went to the old Xavier and Genizano connection. Yeah. So there's a lot like that. But it's amazing. She's an amazing mother as well. So it makes my job pretty easy. You're more of a supporting act in the first few months, but it's unbelievable. It changes your life, you know, for the better. And it's amazing. It's definitely challenging. It tests your relationship a hell of a lot. It's up and down with things and lack of sleep and decisions you're making after 2 hours sleep or whatever. Probably not the best ones, but. I love her little Ivy, so little girl, and it's amazing. It's the greatest thing ever, most rewarding thing, and it'll just continue to get better as she sort of gets more reactive and her personality starts to come out. And I'm excited. Have you got any advice as a father of two and almost three?
They just enjoy it. They grow up so quickly, and you just see them transform into just. Like for me, little girls and just like they were babies and then all of a sudden she's bossing me around and telling me, what song she wants every single time we get in the car, Kun Matata and buddy, it's the best roller coaster. It honestly is. And you'll love it. So what does the future hold for yourself now? So you've sold your business. What's the future hold then, business-wise, if you know? And then, I mean, you mentioned before maybe getting back to playing again, footy. I know you got...
flirting with the idea.
Flirting with the idea. I know, like, you'd be someone very similar to me. He's very competitive and wants to always challenge yourself, like you do the New York Marathon. I mean, you've always got to probably have that next thing to train for or to be invested in. Otherwise, you sort of float.
Oh, absolutely.
So what's the next thing? Because I can definitely give you some ideas to jump on the bandwagon with me.
Challenge if you got. I don't know if I'd run from Sydney to Melbourne.
Oh, you never know.
No, I agree with that in terms of if you don't have a challenge or something in front of you, you definitely do just float. And I think for me, it's amazing my mental health definitely wavers or, you know, get more anxious and just down when I'm not moving. And I think that's I suppose when I've got a lot of things going on, I'll have more of a sense of calm than I do if I've got nothing going on, because your mind's not racing, you're focused on the next thing. So I'm not 100% sure on what the next move will be. My partner's got a business. She's got a baking business called Bake Me, Cake Me, and potentially looking at sort of getting involved in that a little bit to try and do a few things in terms of business development there. Yeah, for me, I don't know, that the mental health resilience space does really interest me a lot.
Yeah.
So whether that becomes something, you know, I do a bit of stuff with Movember and I'm involved with an organisation called Tackle Your Feelings as well, which I think is a brilliant program for community level sport in terms of equipping everyone to be able to have the conversations that, you know, potentially might save a life.
Yep.
So those things, I really enjoy those different avenues, but then whether it is coaching or the business side of sport, not sure. So just starting to have conversations with people now, which I'll go down over the next few months, and then make a decision on what it looks like from here.
Good. Well, I'm sure whatever's next on the menu for yourself will be. I'm looking forward to seeing it, because I know you're very dedicated and you're an inspiring man. I mean, the story you've been through with your sporting career is, as you said, one of a kind, and just to keep trucking along and keep putting your head down and to get back. I know probably, I mean, that game you come back and play for your first time after 5.5 years is probably just as special as the grand final because of the work you had to do to get there. And that just, speaks volume of the character to keep going and that determination. So big thank you for coming on board for the Conway Show. We've got our few big episodes coming up. Big thank you for coming on board.
No, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me in.
No worries.